Today at Reader's Corner, W. Joseph Campbell, author of Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism.
We're not talking run-of-the-mill routine errors that inevitably are going to be committed by journalists. We're talking about prominent stories about and or by the news media that are widely believed and often retold, but which prove to be apocryphal or wildly exaggerated. These media myths are not trivial. They do have adverse consequences, and one of those potential adverse consequences is to distort policymaking. They can also feed stereotypes, too. The book really is aligned with the central objective of news gathering in America, to get it right to the extent that you possibly can.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Many of us know the story behind the 1938 broadcast of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, the radio play based on a science fiction novel by H.G. Wells about an invasion from Mars. When the play aired, a large part of the listening audience mistakenly assumed it was a live news report, and widespread panic ensued. But is that what really happened? And how about Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who are widely credited with bringing down Richard Nixon? Did their investigation of the Watergate scandal result in Nixon's resignation? Journalism professor W. Joseph Campbell takes on these and other legendary stories of media power, stories he's convinced are media-driven myths, in his 2010 book, Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. In a fascinating exploration of these and other cases, including the supposedly outstanding coverage of New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, Dr. Campbell describes how myths can feed stereotypes, deflect blame from policymakers, and overstate the power and influence of the news media. Dr. Campbell is a professor in the School of Communications at American University in Washington, D.C. He entered journalism education after more than 20 years as a newspaper and wire service journalist, a career that took him across North America and to West Africa, Europe, and Asia. He has written four other books on various aspects of journalism, including Yellow Journalism, Puncturing the Myths, Defining the Legacies, and The Year That Defined American Journalism, 1897 and the Clash of Paradigms. Dr. Campbell joins us today by phone from Washington. W. Joseph Campbell, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's start with your own career and how that may or may not have coincided with choosing this as a topic for a book. Did you, in your career over the years, get concerned about the extent to which misreported stories became legend rather than fact or truth?
It did. I think mostly in my career in journalism education, more so than my 20 years as a newspaper and wire service reporter. And it really stems in many respects from my teaching at American University in Washington. In the various courses I've taught over the years, some of the topics and some of the legends, frankly, while appealing and interesting and important and prominent for sure, some of them just didn't sound quite right. And in journalism, in the profession, people call this the sniff test. You kind of give it a sniff and see if it frankly smells okay. And the more I taught these courses with some of this content and the more I looked into it, the less it was able to pass my sniff test. And I'm thinking here of a quote that's often attributed to Lyndon Johnson after he supposedly watched Walter Cronkite's special report on Vietnam at the end of February 1968. And Cronkite closed this special report about Vietnam in the aftermath of the Tet Offensive in early 1968 by saying that the U.S. military was mired in stalemate in Vietnam and that negotiations probably would be the best way to extricate the country from the morass in Vietnam. Supposedly, Lyndon Johnson at the White House was watching the Cronkite show that night, and upon hearing Cronkite's assessment about mired in stalemate, Johnson supposedly leaned over and snapped off the television set and said to an aide or aides, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America," or something to that effect. And the fact that there are a number of versions of what the president supposedly said, and the fact that it was such a neat and tidy and pithy quotation, it just began to seem suspect to me. It just didn't pass the sniff test. And the more I began to look into that anecdote, which makes up a chapter in Getting It Wrong, the more I looked into the anecdote, the more it became obvious that that was apocryphal
And in that case, it's really not a question of blaming the media necessarily. I mean, first of all, if you trail back to the source of that, I assume you're going to find that there was an aide or two that was involved in getting this thing started.
Well, the anecdote's power is in its immediate and decisive, visceral impact on the president, that Walter Cronkite carried such gravitas and right. such importance that his assessment could change American policy, could change the mind and the thinking of a president. Because it's often said that within a few weeks, Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for re-election. Linking the Cronkite program, Johnson's reaction, and Johnson's subsequent decision not to run for re-election. But on close inspection, this anecdote is almost certainly apocryphal. Johnson did not see the program when it aired. He was not at the White House. He was not in front of a television set. Lyndon Johnson, at the time of Cronkite's famous broadcast, was on the University of Texas campus. He was attending a birthday party, the 51st birthday party of Governor John Connally, one of Johnson's longtime political aides. And at the time that Johnson was saying, you know, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America, what he actually was saying was he was making lighthearted jokes and banter about John Connally's turning 51. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to see how the president could have been much influenced by a program he didn't see. As I say, the power of this anecdote is in the immediate and decisive influence it had on the president.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the role of the media here, I may have let the media off too easily by saying we can't always blame them, or however I put it. In this particular case, I could see that it would be in CBS interest for sure in moving this little media myth, as you media-driven myth, as you call them, along in order to spread the vast power and influence of the network.
I think that's what it has. That's the interpretation that it has today, that this is often identified as an example, as Exhibit A, perhaps, in the lineup of evidence that shows how television, how the news media, how the broadcast media can have such powerful and influential effect on American life and American policy. But looking closely at this anecdote, it's just not the case. In fact, Cronkite, for many years, denied that this program had much effect on Johnson at all. He likened it in his memoir, which came out in the mid-90s, to the final straw on a camel's back or something to that effect. Later in life, though, Cronkite did embrace the anecdote and its power and its supposed influence. But for many years, he resisted the notion that this was very influential at all. But it has taken on that aura. It has taken on that interpretation of being a very powerful moment in television, in broadcast history. David Halberstam was one of those who promoted and pushed this story. He included it in his book, The Powers That Be. He didn't put Johnson's supposed comment, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America." He didn't put that inside quotation marks. But nonetheless, the paraphrase was there, and over the years it has assumed quotation marks. Mm-hmm. Another thing about that anecdote is that it has various versions as to what Johnson supposedly said, and that's what I call version variability. And if you have an acute case of version variability, it's almost always, almost certainly a marker of a media myth. It is so in this case as mm-hmm. well.
Now, you have 9 other cases. We're going to talk about some of them in as much time as we have. But before we get there, you mentioned applying the sniff test to these cases, as you've done in your research to write this book. I guess I have to ask the extent to which the journalism industry, especially the schools of communication like yours, can adequately teach the sniff test to reporters, because if you stop and look at most of these cases, somewhere along the line, it was the reporters on the scene that to some extent didn't apply a very good sniff test. Katrina comes to mind, and let's reserve our time later for talking about Katrina, because I have a couple of questions on that. But I guess I just ask you whether or not you think there isn't some responsibility here on the part of the reporters on the scene when it comes to the initial news reporting just being off, not getting it.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that reporters do have an obligation, a major obligation, to apply the sniff test, to be skeptical, and not to take the word of their sources, be they official or unofficial, as gospel. I really do think that reporters often get caught up in being too beholden to their sources, and not being skeptical enough. And the coverage of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans was certainly a case in point that some of these wild stories about apocalyptic violence and mayhem and so forth that supposedly gripped the city in the aftermath of Katrina's passage, just stunning and startling tales of unimaginable violence. But very little, if any, of that proved to be true. And I think that reporters, though covering a hurricane and in conditions of limited, at best, electricity and so forth, and limited communications, reporters still have an obligation to apply skepticism, to be as skeptical as possible, and even more so, I would argue, in the cases when communication lines are down, when it's very difficult to report the story. Those are breeding grounds for rumor and exaggeration, and reporters really ought to be wary of that and prepared for that. There's been some research that has been done by others who've looked into reporting about disasters, and almost predictably, the immediate aftermath of disaster coverage is characterized by exaggeration, by wild tales that prove not to be true. And so there is ample evidence for reporters to have to apply skepticism, to be very, very careful, especially in the immediate aftermath of a disaster that knocks out communication links and makes reporting especially tough.
Help us understand the consequences of not dealing with media-driven myths. Your book is obviously focused on debunking these media-driven myths, but you didn't just sit down to write this for your own edification. You're really concerned about a larger set of issues, I guess.
Well, you know, I think the book really is aligned with the central objective of news gathering in America, and that is to get it right, to the extent that you possibly can. And so the book does really seek to set the record straight by offering a searching reappraisal of these prominent stories. We're not talking in the book about run-of-the-mill routine errors that are inevitably are going to be committed by journalists. I mean, it just happens. It just happens. We're talking about prominent stories about and or by the news media that are widely believed and often retold, but which prove to be apocryphal or wildly exaggerated when given some close inspection. So these are media myths, media-driven myths, are really dubious tales that masquerade as factual. And I think that setting the record straight about these prominent stories about and or by the news media is really very important. It's very important for the understanding by journalists and media consumers about the news media, the media and their power and their influence. And I think this book tries to place in a more coherent context the question of media power. How influential are the media really? And I come down on the side of often media power is exaggerated, is not as pronounced or as prominent as most people would tend to believe.
Well, I also would make the point, it seems, that can't some of these cases have some important public policy implications if the media is reporting something? And I think of Katrina, for example, but there's some other examples you have in these cases where if you don't get it right, you're going to send some policy-making authority down some road that is probably not best traveled.
That's exactly right, and it certainly was the case in the coverage of Hurricane Katrina. The media reports about apocalyptic violence in the city and the aftermath really had the effect of delaying the delivery of much-needed aid to the city. There's no doubt about that. And so that, in a very prominent and powerful policy way, it really messed things up in New Orleans for perhaps 48 hours. So it does have myths are not inconsequential. These media myths are not trivial. They do have adverse consequences, and one of those potential adverse consequences is to distort policy making. They can also feed stereotypes too, and sticking for a moment with Katrina, the exaggerated news reports about the nightmarish violence in New Orleans after Katrina really had the effect of defaming this city and its people at a time of their most dire need. And I really think that was terribly unfortunate and unnecessary, and it was a real mess up by the news media, frankly.
You know, you quote Dan Rather in this regard on the Katrina thing, where he's just showering praise on the media for its incredible coverage of Katrina. And then later, of course, a couple of reporters, I don't know how to pronounce the gentleman's name, Thévenot and Russell, were the two guys who, I guess, did a story in an attempt to set the record straight on all the inaccurate reporting. And boy, it makes Dan Rather's statements look really silly. Do you ever hear from these guys? There's so many of these cases in this book, but I mean, Rather's still running around somewhere doing things here and there. Do they ever get back to you after they hear about your book?
You know, that's a very good question. I've not heard from Dan Rather, and you're quite right. His comments about the coverage of Katrina, I mean, he said something like it represented one of the quintessential great moments in television news, and likened it to the Nixon-Kennedy debates of 1960, the coverage of the assassination of Kennedy in 63, and, you know, even the Watergate coverage. And yeah, he was really flowery in his praise. He said it was nothing short of a landmark, but it's quite clear that both print and broadcast messed that coverage up. It was no high heroic moment for American journalism because the coverage was so flawed and so exaggerated, and they got it wrong. They really erred on in many important ways, and as I said earlier, it had the effect of besmirching the good reputation of a city and its people at a time of their most acute need.
So in the case of the Watergate scandal, it wasn't just the media that participated, but Hollywood played its role. All the President's Men has convinced all of us that Woodward and Bernstein are the big heroes of the day. Your research shows otherwise?
That's right. It sure does. And it's interesting that the Washington Post periodically over the years has tried to disassociate itself from this notion that Woodward and Bernstein and the Post at large brought down Nixon through its dogged investigative reporting. I mean, Katharine Graham, who was the publisher of the Post during and after Watergate, has tried during her lifetime to make that clear that it wasn't the Post's reporting that did it, and others, including an ombudsman and other prominent people at the Post, over the years have tried to say, no, it wasn't us. And even Bob Woodward on one occasion has said something to the effect of, if to say the press brought down Nixon, well, that's just horse bleep. And it may be an earthy characterization, it certainly is, but it's I think very telling about the Post and its attempts, if not in a concerted way, but periodically, they've tried to say, no, it wasn't us. And that's really true. To unravel a scandal of the complexity and dimension and sweep of Watergate really took the coordinated efforts of many investigative agencies, both the Justice Department, FBI, both houses of Congress, and ultimately the Supreme Court. And all of these entities typically were wielding subpoena power to compel testimony. And even then, Richard Nixon probably would have served out his second term as president had it not been for his decision to secretly tape record many of his conversations in the Oval Office. And it was those tape recordings that he resisted surrendering until he was ordered to do so by the Supreme Court in July of 1974, and the recordings that he was compelled to turn over included what came to be known as the smoking gun tape, which quite clearly showed Nixon in June of 1972, not long after the break-in that was the seminal crime of the Watergate scandal, that Nixon was conspiring with H.R. Haldeman to deter the FBI's investigation into Watergate. And that quite clearly showed his obstructing justice in the Watergate scandal. Hence, the tape became known as the smoking gun tape and really was the final fulcrum that got Nixon out of office. Woodward and Bernstein did not disclose the existence of the taping system. They did not disclose the existence of the high-level cover-up and payment of hush money to people to keep their silence about what happened in Watergate. I mean, their reporting was solid, was good. It won a Pulitzer Prize for the Post in 1973, but it alone was not enough to remove Richard Nixon and bring down his corrupt presidency.
You're listening to Joseph Campbell. He is the author of Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism. Let's talk about one of these other ones that's related to high-quality cinematic treatment, and I'm referring to Good Night and Good Luck, which was, of course, Murrow's famous sign-off line, and the movie was released in 2005. Boy, I remember going to that movie and was so excited to see it and so impressed with the movie itself, and probably walked out of there with all kinds of of assumptions that I shouldn't have carried out of there, thanks to the research I read in your book. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you very much for the compliment. And the movie Good Night and Good Luck was very well done, very sophisticated movie, and filmed, of course, in black and white to sort of evoke the time period, the 1954 period, when Edward R. Murrow did a very aggressive 30-minute program about the witch-hunting ways of Senator Joseph R. McCarthy from Wisconsin. The trouble is that movie leaves the clear impression, there's no other interpretation you can come away with other than Edward R. Murrow and his team effectively brought down or exposed the witch hunting ways of Joe McCarthy and had the effect of bringing to a sudden halt McCarthy's witch hunt, which is actually not true at all. Edward R. Murrow was quite late in taking on Joe McCarthy. He did so in 1954, which was years, in some cases, years after other reporters had addressed and called attention to McCarthy's exaggerations, McCarthy's willingness to really corrupt the investigative process of the Senate, to try to promote this notion that communists were everywhere, were embedded everywhere in the government, in the army, and so forth. And among those reporters who took on McCarthy when it was not safe to do so, when there was some risk of physical harm even in doing so, one of those reporters was named Drew Pearson. He was an aggressive, muckraking reporter who wrote the syndicated column Washington Merry-Go-Round. So he was widely read. And Pearson was on top of this McCarthy story almost from day one. McCarthy first went out with his communist and government claim in February 1950. And within days, McCarthy was being skewered by Drew Pearson in Pearson's columns. And not just once. It wasn't a one-off thing. It was a consistent, repeated, frequent look at McCarthy and the exaggerations that the senator was putting out. And McCarthy was kind of a rough-and-tumble character. And after a few months of this, he approached Drew Pearson on one occasion and said, and put his hand on Pearson's shoulder and said, you know, something to the effect of, I'd really like to break your arm sometime. I mean, it was an overt threat that presaged an encounter later in 1950, in December 1950, in which McCarthy and Drew Pearson were together at a dinner party at a hush-hush club in Washington, D.C. called the Soulgrave Club. And throughout the evening, they were exchanging brickbats and barbs and so forth, and veiled threats. And at the end of the evening, when Pearson went to collect his coats and in the cloakroom, McCarthy came up from behind him, put a hand on his shoulder, spun him around, and either slapped him in the face or kneed him in the groin or punched him so hard that it lifted Pearson a couple feet off the ground. I mean, there are different versions as to what supposedly happened, but there was a physical encounter between Pearson and Joe McCarthy. You know, to think today of a U.S. senator assaulting a reporter would just be unthinkable. But back then, you know, McCarthy did it and got away with it, and some people thought it was a great thing for him to do because Pearson wasn't the most likable guy in American journalism.
Right.
He did not have the stellar reputation of Edward R. Murrow. Pearson was a bit of a scuzzy guy, but nonetheless, he was quite clearly on top of this story, going after McCarthy well before Edward R. Murrow even thought of having his program, his See It Now program, take a look at McCarthy. And Pearson paid a price for that. And you have to acknowledge that there was the physical attack. And also, some of his sponsors, one of his major radio sponsors, Pearson had a radio show, one of his major sponsors cut out after the pressure from McCarthy. And it cost Pearson financially as well.
Well, as I listen to these stories dragged out of history, it does seem that most of the 10 misreported stories you tell in this book come from the days when traditional media was doing the reporting. And now we live in this world of blogs and websites like Daily Beast and Slate. The other day, somebody told me that more people are now reading the Huffington Post than the New York Times. I don't know whether that's accurate. I heard it from somebody in the media. Whether it
I
is
heard
or,
that too.
Yeah, whether it is or not, we all know what's going on in the world. And I wonder, to what extent does these new media sources either make it more difficult or easier for us to address these issues that you're really getting at in this book? Or maybe I should say, forget us, help you address the issue. I mean, you're the guy that's in the classroom. You're dealing with this new generation of reporter students who are challenged in ways that old media was not. The 24-hour news cycle. Are we likely to see more or less of these kinds of misreported stories, media-driven myths, based on the way news is now reported today as opposed to the way it was?
I think that new media represent a double-edged sword for myth-making and myth-busting, and I think they can accelerate the circulation of these stories, the diffusion of these apocryphal stories. I don't think there's any doubt about that. On the other hand, I think new media, online technology and so forth can make a difference, can quickly debunk a story if it's not well supported and sort of can cut its legs off before it really has a chance to go very far. But I was reminded, as you asked your question about some of the reporting that Jack Schaefer has done at Slate.com. He's
right.
A media critic for Slate.com and does some great stuff. And periodically he takes a look at a phenomenon known as farm parties. That's PHARM parties, which young people, teenagers, will raid the medicine cabinets of their parents for whatever pills and so forth that they can lay their hands on, take these medications to a party, and dump them into some sort of common bowl, and then take turns grabbing handfuls of these medications to see what kind of high they get. It's a story that has kicked around the news media for years. And there seems to be absolutely no evidence to support the notion that there are farm parties, that anyone has ever attended a farm party and talked about it firsthand, or any police officer has written a report describing a farm party. Yet these stories circulate widely, and in part through new media and old media as well. And so despite many attempts by Schaefer and others to debunk this notion of farm parties, it's a story that's almost too good to die, too delicious not to be true in some respects. And that's a characteristic of many of the media-driven myths that I discuss in Getting It Wrong. I don't talk about farm parties in the book, but maybe I will in a sequel if I take on another 10 media-driven myths, because I don't think the universe of media myths is confined to the 10 that I address and debunk in Getting It Wrong.
Well, in running out of time, that was going to be my last question. You've already taken care of it, because I thought there has to be more than 10 of these. This sounds to me like a cottage industry for Joe Campbell's future. So it looks like we will be. We may be treated to some more of these interesting stories.
Well, I'm keeping a file on them, and you're welcome to offer suggestions, as are your listeners.
Great, great. Well, Joe, it's really been great having you on the show today, and I want to remind our listeners, the book is called Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism by W. Joseph Campbell. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Great. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.